Right, well, thank you for staying for the sessions now. This one is going to be about planning. My name is Joanna Rowell, and I work in planning, policy, and economics. So I'm quite excited to be chairing a session on planning because I should know what I'm talking about. But I'm not so hot on infrastructure, so I'm looking forward to the presentations from these three. I noticed some themes coming through the last session, which are going to be quite interesting for us to pick up. Obviously, there was a lot about community consultation. People are talking about phasing and stakeholders and leadership, and where do you draw the red line? So I'm hoping we can kind of touch on those, being that this is a planning session. I must just tell you, I was in Australia last week on a project, and I heard a really lovely story about community consultation, where the local authority were taking groups of people out to look at a new development, and children were leading the tours and telling them all about how excited they were about new stations and new buildings. So sometimes maybe children are very eloquent at these kinds of things. But we've got three adults. So we've got Jamie Eagles, who is strategic manager for Nine Elms on the South Bank. And then we will have a presentation from Duncan Brown, who is also strategic project manager, but for Whitechapel, a vision delivery team at the London Borough of Tower Hamlets. And then following that, we've got Tim again. Tim's not going to do a full presentation, having already had the floor earlier. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Jamie, who's going to come and take the lectern. Thanks, Jamie.
Hello, I'm Jamie. I'm strategic project manager at Nine Elms, which is one of those sort of job titles that means everything and nothing. Put simply, it covers utilities, trucks, basically construction, logistics, and public realm. And I'll try and touch on the fact that, to my mind, these things are really, really quite closely related. Just a little bit about Nine Elms to put it into context. Most people have heard of Battersea, not necessarily the wider Nine Elms, Vauxhall area. Huge area, 430 acres, 195 hectares, a pretty good farm, and in the central activity zone. So, I mean, putting that into context, development the size of King's Cross is about, I think, 67 acres. We're an awful lot bigger, and there's an awful lot going on. These are just some numbers. What I haven't specifically put in here, and we heard about it a bit more, was Northern Line Extension, Thames Tideway Tunnel, so some very big tunnels and big bits of infrastructure going into the area. We've got a main drive site for the Thames Tideway Tunnel, as well as two new stations on the way and a third being upgraded. But I think the thing to say is that all of those numbers up there, the 25,000 new jobs, the 6.5 million square foot commercial, all requires an awful lot of pipes and wires to make it work. This is just a slide to give you an idea about the complexity of land ownership. I have a lot of conversations where people talk about, a urban development corporation model, or why weren't you a mayoral development corporation? Put simply, the public sector doesn't own the land. There are multiple land ownerships, multiple complexities, a huge number of developers. Lambeth and Wandsworth maintain the planning with input from the GLA. Now, this gives you an idea about the phasing of development, which is a hideous slide, but the long and the short of it is it all happens now, and it all happens very quickly at the same time with a huge complexity of different partners involved. Part of the context from the planning side was the role of the GLA in setting up the opportunity area planning framework. We were one of the first. That was signed off by the GLA in 2012. A lot of work was done around infrastructure, not just the utilities infrastructure, not just the rail and underground, but everything, the social infrastructure as well. Really good piece of work, but I think an awful lot of assumptions were made that lessons might be learned for other opportunity areas around how infrastructure actually works. And I think a lot of this was around assumptions that an awful lot of these costs would be borne by developers, and to some extent the market would do its own thing, and there wasn't necessarily a huge amount of intervention required. To some extent, some of that's true. For certain areas it was, for certain areas it wasn't. The approach that the partnership took, I think, after that initial study looking at the infrastructure requirement was to commission a collaborative utilities master plan, which is quite novel because, we've got 10 major developers sitting on the partnership board, none of whom generally like to share an awful lot of secrets about things like how much power they've secured and that sort of thing. Those 10 co-funded a joint report, so the poor consultants had an awful experience of having 10 different clients. But the end result of it was it told us in a lot more detail about what we needed to do. The purpose of it was to take all of the developments, those that are in the pipeline now, those that had detailed consent, those that had outline consent, those were at the moment just a bit of a dream, but we had some idea through the planning framework of the sorts of densities of development we could expect on all those individual sites. So taking all of that information in very different levels of detail, all of that was accumulated to work out what the end point was for the utilities that were required in the area. And that was very specific. That was to prevent abortive works, a piecemeal approach whereby each individual developer might go to UK Power Networks and say, we want 3 MVA, and they're obliged to provide the cheapest and quickest option. And then the next one comes along and says, we want 2 MVA, and we need it then, and so on and so on. So what this did enabled us to bring all of what was required into one place and strategically engage with the utility companies and say, this is what we need, and this is when we need it in terms of the key points around phasing of development. This is a horrid graph again. You're not expected to see the detail, but I think the main point of it is these are the main utility upgrade programs, and they happen over about 6 years, and they happen all at different times. And I think a key risk for the partnership, for all the developers and the public sector bodies, was that that could not happen in an uncoordinated fashion. Particularly being as it crosses over, this is a graph showing how many little white vans and big 30-ton HGVs need to start coming through the area, purely associated with the local development. So what we have is basically a utilities infrastructure that needs a huge amount of upgrading from what were logistics sheds to high-density commercial and residential, all of which, all those pipes and wires, pretty much have to be routed through the road network, which is just about to be absolutely pummeled with an unprecedented period of construction activity. So there's a real tension there about how we manage the road network, but also make sure that the utilities upgrades happen when they need to. So the way we've approached it is, appointing me, strategic project manager, and I think part of that remit was quite specific around my role having oversight of not just what utilities required, not for just the big developers, but for some of the developers that weren't even in the room that might be coming to the party 5 years later, and looking after really that what is required to make the whole development happen, but also to take oversight around how the public realm's built out, as well as how we mitigate the negative impacts of construction on the road network, but particularly the utilities upgrade impact on the road network. This is a diagram of one of the... I'll go on to that one. What we also set up was governance structures, which really provide the tools to get things done. So things like the fact that we've got three different highways authorities. At the moment, they now meet. So that if somebody wants to dig a hole in the ground, everybody that's involved in permitting that knows exactly what other holes in the ground are being dug. And I don't know if anyone remembers the Carlsberg advert from years ago, where there's sort of various different utility companies come along and they all use the same pit. It ends with a funeral director, and that was the end of the advert. That's pretty much a summary of what we're trying to do here, but without the funeral director, which is if someone's doing a bit of ducting, we make sure that those bits of ducting that are going to close a bus lane, that actually we work with UK Power Networks around putting the power ducting in later or the comms ducting. So we try and concertina that programme, but also reduce the cost and the impact. We established a special purpose vehicle, basically a company with £1 limited liability. One of the principal reasons behind that was to get over some very significant regulatory barriers, which are about investing ahead of need. Regulations that are there to protect the consumer, the Mrs. Miggins down the road, often don't work to the advantage of informed clients, where you have multiple developers who know exactly what they want, and they don't necessarily want the cheapest option. They might well want the quickest option. But the point is as well, when they're engaging with those utility companies, they can engage with them as one entity and say, we, the development community, require this, rather than having a regulated approach by 10, 15, 20 different developers, all saying different things, which has made life an awful lot easier, I have to say. What we also did was bring in Arup. We went through a very detailed procurement process with all the multiple partners, appreciating the fact that there was a need to strategically manage both the construction logistics issues and the utilities coordination, and that it was impossible to disaggregate the two. This is, again, a horrific diagram, but one which I think is around some of the tools that we're now looking at around how we move from the strategic planning through to the implementation. And one of them is managing a mass of information on very limited road space. So looking at strategic routing, one that can take pipes and cables off of the highway network if at all possible, whether that's running it through key bits of open space, running it down railway viaducts if we can get agreements with Network Rail, running it down river paths so that we can minimise the impact on the local community and the road network. But part of that is also around bringing together huge amounts of information about invasive digs, around different survey work that developers have done, and provide that on an open platform where developers can actually upload the information where they've spent thousands of pounds on surveys, as well as the strategic bits of work around utility routing. Because what we have is a mass of activity. So, for example, putting in a primary substation, huge great big cable that has to go into the area up from the supergrid at Wimbledon, 76 ducts snaking out from there, and those all have to go past water mains, sewerage, and be timed with various other different utilities that are coming along. So I think a really key tool that's been deployed successfully elsewhere, and one which is going to be absolutely essential over the coming years, purely to manage the amount of information that's about. I think everyone knows that the whole regime around how the road networks and utilities operate is fundamentally fairly dysfunctional. What we're attempting to do is to strategically plan that. And some lovely little examples. I was in a meeting the other day where we've got the cycle superhighway just about to go through the area, and TfL are looking at putting in the ducting for a variety of different other service providers, which they can then get an income from later, which also means that we don't have to dig up the cycle superhighway for the next 3 years. And I think a lot of other local authorities will be looking at similar models. Key challenges. I think one of them, defining a cumulative demand and phasing, working out what is the totality of what's required from all development and when does it happen. Strategic land and way leaves. I think quite often big infrastructure, when you're looking at multiple sites, requires land, and that's always the bit that people forget about. And within London, it's always the bit that's massively expensive, and the financing behind it often doesn't work. Regulatory barriers. I think a lot of protection that's in there for the consumer doesn't work to the advantage of the development community as an informed client. And I think the overriding issue that's of difficulty there is around investment ahead of need. So that's utility companies that see that there is a demand, but have a very significant issue in pushing through the investment that's required so that it's there on time, for fear of it being a stranded asset and either being bashed by Ofgem or Ofcom or Ofwat. And collaborative working. I think what we've put an awful lot of effort into is creating an environment where people trust in being able to share information that normally would be extraordinarily sensitive. But I think that's appreciating the fact that the only way we can make what's about to happen over the next few years in Nine Elms work is to work in collaboration. Not because it's a nice thing to do, but because it's essential to make the area work. Plan early. Engage with utility companies early, which we did. I think it's really important to have a clear vision, particularly around some of the added value, like the telecoms. And manage data, which is very boring, but very important. And I think there are some really interesting tools that are now being developed around that. And I think, for my mind, GIS is absolutely essential to it. And governance, sorry. I've now overrun, so I'll shut up.
Thank you, Jamie. We've got quite different presentations today. So has anyone got a question that they would like to ask Jamie now about the words he's just said? Otherwise, we can wait for questions at the end. But if anyone has anything, a burning desire to ask Jamie something right now? Nope. Okay, I'm going to move on. I could ask you lots of questions, but I will save, those so that I can ask all three of you at the end. We now have Duncan Brown, who's going to talk us through the Whitechapel vision. He works for the London Borough of Tower Hamlets as the strategic project manager.
Okay, thank you. I'll press the button. Sorry, green button. It's been pressed for my presentation. Oh, here we go.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, so today I'm going to talk about Tower Hamlets' experience of Crossrail, a very specific infrastructure project, and I think you have heard a lot of this today, so I'll try not to repeat some of the experiences that have been talked about, but certainly I'll be using Whitechapel as a case study. I'm the strategic project manager in the newly formed Whitechapel Vision Delivery Team, very wordy title, but this is a new regeneration team that's been set up by Tower Hamlets to deliver the Whitechapel Master Plan, which was adopted earlier in the year. So quite a provocative question at the start, and I don't really want to come from a sort of a moaning local authority perspective. It's more just to pose the question, what has been the impact within the community, and what have been the benefits and also lessons? So I'll take you through some of those. Quick context on Tower Hamlets, many of you may know, with the fastest growing population in London and the UK, it rose by 44% since 2001, which I think we're all quite surprised by because our own projections didn't anticipate that. We also subsequently have the highest London housing target, so a real big challenge to meet the demand with some 22,000 people on our waiting list. Development activity, though, is very real, and year on year we've been delivering the highest housing figures in London, and I don't think the recession ever really hit Tower Hamlets, it just sort of carried on as normal. So that's obviously a positive sign, but with that comes all the infrastructure and social infrastructure and physical infrastructure that needs to support that growth. We always pull this statistic out or this caption about Colchester. I don't know why we've chose Colchester, but apparently we're 2.5 times smaller than Colchester. We have a population 2.5 times greater than Colchester, and in the next 10 years, we need to accommodate another Colchester. So, and we sort of work that out on infrastructure, and that's 14 new primary schools, 46 new GPs, 3 secondary schools, more libraries, sports halls, 10 supermarkets, and 99 hectares of open space, which is equivalent to the Victoria Park, which is currently in Tower Hamlets. So what did Crossrail pledge to us and to everyone across London? Well, I think the narrative's been well rehearsed by Crossrail in promoting the scheme. But for Tower Hamlets, this meant 2 new stations. And I think we were quite fortunate in securing Whitechapel, because I don't think it was necessarily in the mindset of when they planned the train line. But as we're beginning to realise, having an enormous transformational impact going into the future for the area. So, 57,000 new jobs, £5.5 billion investment, a lot will be in the east of London, and identified by a GVA property report to have large-scale impact. So this was, significant transformation was to be expected, and I think we'd agree with that. So in response to that, we decided, the borough decided that they needed to create a strategic planning framework to manage this and really capture the benefits. So the background of this was, and Crossrail will be pleased to hear, was prompted by the arrival of the station. And this was very much led by the political leadership of the council, who recognised this was an opportunity they couldn't miss, and particularly as the area does have pockets of severe social deprivation and it needed to secure those benefits, certainly in socioeconomic terms. And really, that was the main driver from the start. Secure new housing, which obviously is an acute need in Tower Hamlets, but also jobs, where there's high rates of unemployment locally, particularly amongst young people. So from a strategic planning point of view, we always like to think we do it as a plan-led sort of approach. And we started with our core strategy. So we got the Crossrail recognised within there early on, which then took us to our Managing Development DPD, which started to detail the policies. And they were always focused on how Crossrail will impact upon the area and help the area. And then this prompted the Master Plan 2013, where we then took that and started to translate that into physical form and really intimately plan the spaces to scale. So our ambition, which was big and sometimes maybe too big, I think this was nicknamed the Mini Shard, and I think we secured the copyright permission to put that in, but we'll find out soon. So 3,500 new homes, 5,000 new jobs, and 7 new public squares and open spaces. And I think this is similar to Nine Elms, actually, because the borough doesn't really own much land in the area. So it was very much a facilitating role with the private sector and other public sector bodies like the hospital and Transport for London to unlock the area. And I think the borough's view was very much it would lead on the public rail initiatives and the negotiations and some of the live application sites. And our consultants told us this was worth approximately £1 billion. So we were quite pleased with that. But I think that is obviously subject to ongoing agreement and discussion with those investors. So how is this spatially planned? So we needed to think about how the area worked. We broke it down into six what we called key place transformation areas. Not the most glamorous of titles per transformation area, but they tried to give a sense of local identity. So Durwood Street Gardens was one where we were promoting a brand new open space on Durwood Street at the back of the station and with new public realm and housing around. One that did emerge, which was interesting to us, was the MedCity campus, which Queen Mary University were wanting to expand their life science offer with Royal London Hospital. And we identified a significant cluster there, which is already there, but they had big ambitions and plenty of money to invest. So we were quite welcoming of that intervention. And what does this actually look like on plan? So BDP worked with us to produce the master plan, and we tried to translate it into physical form. And again, it's all about animating areas around the Crossrail entrances and the station. And really give it some life. Currently, the public realm around there I don't know if you've been down there, it's not the best, and it's not the most, it's a legible environment. So we tried to give a sense of reality to local people of what this could look like, and you know, that's been a challenge, but I think we are broadly getting there. And this was the other key area where Crossrail, this was where the value of the master plan came into its own, because the second entrance had been stripped out from the Crossrail's commitment to Whitechapel, which was regrettable because it ended up being the only station which doesn't have two entrances. So we were keen to get that firmly back on the map in terms of strategic planning and back in the mindset of Transport for London. So this is around the new Sainsbury site, where they're redeveloping site, and Sainsbury is very keen to do this. This is their next London project, and a very similar format to Nine Elms, I think, in terms of what they're doing around the new Northern Line station. So, and this one's coming in soon, so we're quite excited about this one. And Sainsbury's are providing some new public realm at the back of the site, which on the photo on the left, that's the back of the idea store, and that space has been closed for about 8 years now. So we're looking forward to that opening again. So who is the Strategic Delivery Partnership? This is recently formed, actually. This only met last month, and these are the key institutional partners, and there's a real commitment from each of these partners to delivery generation, many of which have land ownership, but the Mayor of London and Transport for London are key players in that partnership. So what are the key challenges? I'll quickly rattle through these last few slides. So key challenges for us and experiences, and I think you've heard some of those today through Bob and others who have mentioned it. This was someone told me this statistic recently. 40% of all Crossrail complaints are from Whitechapel. So I don't know if it's from Bart Simpson and all his friends, but it's basically a real issue down there in terms of the sort of the short and arguably the medium term impacts of Crossrail as a construction operation. And I think what it's done is it has organised groups, and I'll come on to that in a sec, around creating a community capacity. But what we've noticed is that it hasn't engaged in the low-income groups, and particularly those families in social rented accommodation, which are arguably disengaged from political process, democratic process. They're very transient, a lot don't speak English, not quite poorly educated. And it seems that they're the ones who have suffered the most. And often at a moment's notice, families will be decanted to hotel rooms in central London. And that's just not satisfactory. And there's a real lesson to be learned on these big infrastructure projects, particularly when they arrive in inner London, where you need to engage communities which are in particularly social housing estates. There's some debate about whether Crossrail stripped out some of the costs from their original commitments. And we've noticed that maybe in the Cambridge Heath Road second entrance, which I've already mentioned. Maybe another challenge was, has the council arrived too late to the party, and are we creating a master plan, which really a lot of the Crossrail works has already been pre-planned, pre-engineered. But we would say we have arrived at the right time, just in time though, to capture the value that that might bring. Move on to the opportunities, that's just going on from that. Created the community capacity, so we have organised community groups now, and we've really benefited that in the master plan, so we have identified groups. It's prompted us as a local authority to set up a community liaison officer, and Bob is that person. And we also have a team who meet regularly on a weekly basis to meet with Crossrail to communicate the community's concerns. And this has built up a capacity within the council to anticipate other projects like Thames Tunnel, like Silvertown Tunnel, where we're already thinking of mitigation strategies and resourcing teams around those infrastructure projects. So just a few other benefits. We've had over £100 million of private acquisition since 2013, and it's triggered TfL to seriously consider overstation development, which is apparently valued at over £500 million. Some final future infrastructure for infrastructure projects, the experiences which we can hopefully help other boroughs around, is basically adopt a master planning approach. It has really helped us in this case. Prioritise your interventions so you can negotiate with the publics and private sector. Community engagement, I can't emphasise this enough, is critical in such an early stage, particularly with hard-to-reach communities. And recognising every project needs a bespoke approach. And I know that's quite obvious, but I can't emphasise that enough. And focus on quality and meaningful outcomes. And that's my lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is this the right one? Never mind. There we go. Time for a break. I'm going to make this quite short, as Joanna said, because you've heard enough of me already, and I don't have the great slides that these two other guys have had to show you about a particular area. So I was asked just to come along and do a quick sort of, in a way, wrap-up and sort of respond to the questions. I think it's worthwhile just made thinking of what we actually are trying to do with infrastructure. Infrastructure is the hallmark of civilization. It's the prerequisite to make sure we can live the way we want to live in the way that in a dense urban area. Working out actually the density of Colchester compared to Tower Hamlets, I now work out it's about 7 times denser, and that's quite a lot of people in a very small area. So civilization is defined as a human society that has highly developed material and spiritual resources and a complex cultural, political, and legal organization, an advanced state and social development. And to make that happen, we need 2 types of infrastructure. We need social infrastructure, which is education and healthcare, and we need physical infrastructure, what's called economic infrastructure, which is the transport, water, energy, waste, telecoms, which crudely can be characterized as utilities. And I count transport in that as well, although sometimes people count transport as separate from other utilities. But it's all about effectively moving people through pipes, whether it's actually electrons, water, waste, or people. The critical thing is, as I said earlier, it's not just about building shiny new stuff. I think too often we tend to think about infrastructure in terms of a shiny new project. Actually, infrastructure is composed of systems and interrelated networks. And the shiny new stuff needs to happen sometimes, but the critical thing is actually what the infrastructure achieves. And so we should think more about the output that we're trying to create, I think, rather than the projects per se. And when we come on to output, we should think about both level of service and level of reliability, because they're the things that we think about as consumers of infrastructure that we want to work. We want to have enough of an infrastructure, and we want it to be there reliably. When a road or a rail link breaks down, we all know the consequences very badly. But when something breaks down that's more fundamental, like electricity or telecoms, actually we suffer far worse. And I think the same concepts need to come into play when we think about all types of infrastructure. Also, there's some fundamental challenges to how we do infrastructure as well. Government is challenging very hard to have more for less, at least a 25% reduction over the next 10 years in how we deliver things. Low carbon agenda is here very strongly. Infrastructure uses over half of the UK's carbon, and therefore, if we're going to change to an 80% reduction in the carbon that we use, we need to make sure infrastructure is there playing its part. And it's about broad sustainability. It's making sure that we can live in a more civilized way. When the tube was first built, there was a very different attitude to people with disabled or disabled people. Nowadays, we actually want to treat them with much more respect, much more inclusion. And so modern tube schemes are all step-free and whatever else, whereas going back to the 1860s, when the tube was built, there was a very, very different attitude to people who were disabled. And finally, I think Jamie again emphasised very strongly the power of BIM and GIS, both to transform what we're doing in terms of information and information management and making sure we do things much more slickly than we ever have done before. So there's several new paradigms coming about how we create infrastructure going forward. And the critical thing is, I think, this very system-based thinking to make sure we get away from shiny projects and think about critically what we as consumers want to achieve. About a year ago, the government published a thing called the Infrastructure Carbon Review, and I was fortunate to be on the steering group for that. And that spoke about a hierarchy of how things happen. And we tend to think in the construction industry about there's designers and there's contractors who build things, but we answer to asset owners, and they're the people I think through both Duncan and Jamie talking to. They, in turn, are regulated by regulators, ORR or Ofwat or Ofcom or something like that. They respond to Parliament, and then they respond to voters. And we tend to think of this sort of value chain because each of us think that we can't influence things enough. We all think politicians are really at fault when something goes wrong. Actually, they're terrified of we voters. All utilities, all infrastructure requires someone to pay for it, whether it comes from taxation or whether it comes from usage charges. But again, we tend to think too often as infrastructure something which just happens, and we don't think about how it gets paid for. So there's a time, I think, to try and think about infrastructure in a very joined-up way, which, again, we've heard about in both presentations, and especially, I think, Jamie's very, very neat encapsulation of how utilities come together. So the critical thing going forward is to think about whole-life cost for infrastructure and how we achieve a level of output over a 25- or 50-year period, or even over a 2,000-year period, because that's how long infrastructure lasts for. So if you go to the A5 road, I say it has been there since Roman times. It's been upgraded at various stages, but infrastructure, once it happens, is here to last. And the value chain, I think, is critical as well, and the stakeholders. So we need to tell the story to everybody, and we spoke a bit about HS2 and the story that they are telling, which is becoming much more coherent as we go forward. But each of these projects has to have a value story about the people who are going to use the infrastructure in the future. And if we do that well, I think we can avoid bad infrastructure. We can all think of infrastructure, especially in post-war infrastructure, which tended to be put in as a very, very naive intrusion into the cityscape. There's really good examples all over the world of bad urban motorways. London was meant to have 4 or 5 ringways around it, which were going to hugely come through. Tottenham Court Road was going to be a slipway to an urban motorway along the Euston Road. These things are forgotten about, but that was only 30 years ago. And imagine a London that actually had these 4 urban motorways carved through it, and the level of dislocation and cutting of societies. So I think infrastructure has come a long way. I think we plan it now much more intelligently, but I think we have a chance to actually build on what we have and do it far more intelligently along the ways that have been spoken about. Thank you.